Welcome back to Misunderstood Podcast. We're two episodes down. We've heard from the old, we've heard from the new. We're kind of going to revert back to the old because I think slowly but surely I hopefully can get into university conversations, university leaders. But today I'm here with Kwande, a person who goes to a school that I dislike vividly. We don't have to address that, but for everyone who knows boys' school drama, St. John's and St. Stidian's aren't the best of friends. But also this year, I mean, yeah, there was historical events that happened. But today we're here to speak about his journey, his experience in student politics as he prepares to exit or kind of has exited already. Yeah. How are you doing today, brother?
I'm surviving. You know, prelims weren't ideal, but you know, I'm all right.
How are you feeling now that you have left your institution in terms of your position? And what's your sentiment to your school after having been with them for a year, leading them and being part of pivotal conversations?
I think I'm excited to leave. Honestly, it's been a lot of hard work over the last year, and I'm kind of relieved to kind of have the mental stress of it off of me. Sentiment wise, I think over the years, and particularly in this last year, I've begun to kind of cool off in a bit. I used to be a very sort of radical, you know, I don't like the place, you know, a lot needs to change. And I guess I've begun, now that I actually see the like underpinnings of everything, I've begun to be a bit more understanding of, you know, how I guess politics is played, you know, how tradition plays a role, how conservatism plays a role. So yeah. I think I've kind of cooled off and been able to, you know, almost, I still think I've fought for change, but it's been in a much more measured way and in a much more, you know, realistic way, considering, you know, the circumstances. Yeah.
What would you say is the biggest change that you've seen since entering your institution to now having left it 5 years later?
I think what is considered normal and what is celebrated in the school has changed quite dramatically. I think how we see it is our matric class when we were in grade 8 was almost the last of the old guard pre-COVID. And we had just switched heads of school in terms of like staff. And that kind of represented a generation shift. So those were the last of the super macho guys, you know, the top guys with the first team players, that type of guys. And obviously, you know, there were appreciations of different types of presentations. But I think over the years, I've witnessed a shift in, you know, still very much the discrimination, whatever exists. But I think what is the scope of normal has shifted, which I think is a positive change. I think people are in a space where they are able to express different kinds of being a student of my school and being a male or boy, or even, you know, we've seen discussions of gender politics change quite dramatically. So I think overall positive change. Obviously, I'm always going to say there's a way to go, but I think, yeah, I've seen that sort of shift. Yeah.
I mean, that's interesting that you say that and that you feel that, because I didn't actually think about COVID being so impactful in changing the identity of certain schools. But I also think a lot of schools culturally have changed, and it's shown in terms of what they celebrate, so on and so forth. If my research is correct, your school has a very interesting political framing with your girls' school, which is on the exact same campus. Yeah. How does that affect politics? How does that affect people engaging with different identity conversations? And how did you navigate that, having been in leadership and having to deal with various issues that may have arose?
I think on a institutional level, it is, I guess, simpler. It's more just about coordination of policies. So, you know, codes of conduct are aligned, that type of thing. But I think where it gets much more contentious is like on the ground, you know, with individual students dealing with each other. So we've tried to encourage, you know, synergy or like working with each other. So, you know, a prefect who's head of transformation at the boys' side is gonna be encouraged to work with the girls' side. And I think that has fluctuated in how successful it's been over my 5 years. And I think witnessing it almost firsthand, I only realized this year that there's very like deep-seated, you know, tensions that I think still need to be like properly sat down and resolved, that I don't know who's gonna be able to push that sort of agenda to sit down. But there is always going to be politics associated with it. And I think the two schools themselves have two very different dynamics. So, I mean, the one was 70 years old now,
yeah.
And the girls' school is a lot younger, I think around in the mid-20s. And obviously, the institution as a whole is still considered to be that 70-year-old that started with the boys. And I think that sort of age has meant that for them, tradition hasn't played as much of a role as it has for us. So for instance, for a lot of guys at the boys' school, we would explain something in saying, oh, it's just a tradition. Whereas for them, it's not as much of a strong emphasis. And I think that is kind of the main point. But I think there is a good coexistence. I think for the most part, I guess we do things separately. So all our academics is separate, all our sport is separate. So yeah, I think the coexistence overall is pretty good, but yeah, also ways to go.
I mean, in it being good, how welcoming are you of each other's opinions, but also just of each other as people? Because I think as you identified there, you said that tradition plays a huge aspect in your school where they don't necessarily have much of a historical guide to lean on. And how do you engage with those conversations when people try to make you disregard your history in hopes of being more progressive?
See, I disagree with the notion that history or tradition has to necessarily be directly opposed to being progressive. I think for me, where I see history or tradition playing a role is much more on a point of our values. And I think values aren't going to be fundamentally changed because we have, you know, different conceptions of what masculinity looks like or different conceptions on how we interact with women. And I think for me, I think the point where the conversations have come is that with working with the girls' school, it has exposed a lot of the things that we have trouble explaining. So we do something as a tradition, and yes, it's been this way forever, but when we are asked to justify why it's a particular way, we struggle in doing that. So I think for me, I've now pushed for traditions to exist, yes, but exist because they still bring value and not traditions for the sake of traditions, especially when there are traditions that are actively harming someone's feeling of belonging within the school. I don't know if I answered the question.
No, you definitely did, because I think you speak to the idea of people not only just drawing something value from something because it's existed, but because there's actually value that people gain. What's your experience been having worked with other various schools in terms of how far progressive your school is, considering that you have a girl constituency on campus? Do you feel that at least in conversations that your school is further ahead, or do you still feel like you're at the same point as other boys' schools?
Wow. You know, there was a point where I definitely felt that the influence of the girls' school allowed us to be slightly more advanced in terms of where we are compared to most boys' schools. But
yeah,
I think that role is still there, and I think definitely having active engagement kind of keeps you, I want to say, in check, but also just pops the bit of a bubble that tends to emerge amongst boys schools where you in your own environment and you don't really hear outside voices. But I think it's also difficult because, you know, a lot of the issues are common amongst, you know, your school, my school. I don't think it's necessarily that I don't want to, you know, get on a high horse and say that we are ahead of anyone. I think we still, you know, have a lot of issues. But I think there's a unique role that having such a large constituency of girls on campus does play in, you know, chats. Yeah.
Fair. When you stepped into office a year ago versus where you are now, what was your vision? And how do you feel you've enacted on that vision? Do you feel like you completed it and you're able to walk away and say it was done? Or do you feel that because of the roadblocks that may have existed along the way, it was a good vision to have, but it isn't necessarily what ended up happening?
Funny, I gave this advice to my successor and I told him that I think vision can't be almost a thing that dictates what you do throughout your year. I think being responsive is a key part of leadership. So I found that I definitely can't say I've completed everything I wanted to achieve. You know, I pushed quite heavily to analyze a lot of the traditions, you know, some of the punishments we were using and we're still using, I feel like are a bit outdated and don't actually, you know, end up being effective. So I tried to change that. Or just how we acknowledge or celebrate different types of achievements in the school, I guess that has been almost achieved. But I think what I didn't realize is, one, how much bureaucracy exists at the school and how difficult it is to get anything done. You know, there's so many processes which are probably good, but it's just, you know, you don't have the understanding of that till you actually get there. And two, a lot of my time and like mental energy is almost plugging holes or, you know, being called upon to give my judgment. So instead of being able to implement a grand vision, it's the nitty-gritty, you know, someone did this, what do you guys say? We need your thoughts on what the students are saying about this, which I think I played a good role in that, but I just didn't fully understand that aspect of it before I went into office. So I guess that has, you know, taken a lot of my energy.
I hear that. And I hear that because I think one of the things that they hide from you until you get to leadership is the idea that there is process and there's process that you're going to have to follow, but also that a lot of your time is wasted. Well, I don't necessarily think wasted. I think it's what comes with the responsibility, but is used in you trying to simply do the day-to-day stuff that doesn't necessarily lead to anything beyond just a judgment. How involved did you actually feel in your school making decisions in terms of them listening to the student body, in terms of them actually taking opinions and doing things that were in the best interest of students?
I think how I always explain it to people, and I was asked by grade 10, it happened to be a thing that came up, and I always say that if you look at the influence you have as a prefect and in my position, it will end up being more than any other regular student or non-prefect student. But you still have to put it in perspective that at the end of the day, the final call is always going to be with the staff. And once you accept that, I think it makes, you know, your just mental well-being a lot easier when you can say, you know what, this one is out of my hands. I'm not even going to fight it. It's above me. And I think once you learn how to work in the space of, okay, this is the realm for what students can do, then I think you become a lot more comfortable. But to be honest, I think I've had a lot of influence on quite major decisions. I mean, I've dealt with disciplinary issues that have been quite serious. I've dealt with trying to push for changes in policies on how we address like things like racism incidents. And I think in that sense, I actually underestimated initially how much influence I'd be able to have. But I think there's definitely many decisions that are just, you know, above my pay grade.
Fair. My question, which kind of goes to what I said in the intro about our schools disliking each other, but also boys' schools culture in general, in terms of engaging with each other, which I think in the progressiveness of society is probably the least progressive thing that we have about our schools. How have you felt during those engagements, and what arose from those engagements that you feel like is just things that we tend to believe are blind spots? Because obviously between the boys' schools, but specifically between the Saints schools, there's a huge rivalry. And part of that rivalry also extends to how we then implement our egos, our pride in how we engage on the day to day.
I think the rivalry conversation, I think maybe schools need to engage better in setting boundaries, because I think a lot of the conflict that has come up is that we find something hasn't crossed our line, but then you guys, for instance, think it's crossed your line. And that's where a lot of the points of contention, and then it goes into pull back and forth. Oh, you know, 20, whatever, you guys did this, then this. And I think there needs to be a much more, concerted effort in placed in, you know, sitting down and saying, okay, guys, the nitty gritty of it. When we have a fixture, if you win the fixture, what can we do? What will you guys be seriously offended if you do? And, you know, we can walk into a fixture knowing that, okay, we can tell our school that, you know, if we happen to win, we get to do this, you know, as an appropriate level of celebration. But I think I also don't want to lose the rawness of it all. I think part of the what makes, you know, the times where the school does feel connected, and maybe it is slightly problematic, but I, you know, it's fine. I think part of being so connected as to the people sitting next to you in your school is when you are faced with a major opposition. I think that's just basic human nature, right? So I found when we play St. John's, you know, a lot of the divisions, the tension in the school kind of goes away, and we can rally behind, you know, going against St. John's. And I imagine it's similar for you guys.
Yeah.
So I think I don't want to completely, you know, codify and police these rivalries. I think there does need to be an element of almost law in it, so that we can say that, look, you know, back in 2018, your matrix did this back. And it's like, you know, but I think definitely there is a point where it gets too far. And I think that we need to have difficult conversations about that. Yeah.
A stupid question to that is how much of what you've gone through and the events that you've experienced as a result of being at Saints defines who you think you're going to be and what you hold true to you in the future?
I think part of it is, I guess, out of my control. I guess going into, you know, for me, I have always had a vision of being involved, at least in some capacity, in politics in this country. And I guess whether fairly or unfairly, there's a certain, you know, I don't want to say stigma. Stigma is the wrong word. But there's certain baggage that going to an elite private school carries with you. And I think I'm gotten to a point where I'm comfortable with that. That's who I am. I'm not gonna try and pretend to not be that person, and that is a potential blind spot that I have to acknowledge. But I think the other part of it, I guess, it's shown me how within a country like South Africa that claims to be, you know, I guess, push this whole Rainbow Nation narrative, they exist bubbles of completely different political discussions or political ideas. So you go to school and you realize that the conversations you're having are like completely separated from the rest of the country, you know. And I feel like that is a potential issue. And I think I've been fortunate to have experiences where I do break out of that, where I can engage with people who don't have any idea about that lifestyle or that culture, and I can see what, for the most part, the real South Africa looks like. So I think maybe another thing I did try to push, and I probably haven't been successful in doing it, is saying that, guys, we don't exist as an island. We exist within Johannesburg, we exist within South Africa and Africa and the world. And that means that we need to be plugged into conversations that are happening around us, so that when conversations about, you know, we have a discussion about universities, and a lot of people say, oh, I don't want to go to Wits UCT because there's always protests.
Yeah.
And now, yes, protests disrupt, but there's also a nuanced conversation where, as we're saying, guys, people are not getting funds for their education. And I think that's the problem, is that people exist in this bubble of privilege that the schools aren't doing enough to pop.
How do you bridge that balance? Because obviously you want to engage with the politics. How do you bridge the balance between your experience and somebody who's completely alien to your experience? But also, how do you bring people together who come from completely two separate bubbles?
I think it's difficult. I think it requires, I guess, I want to say that in a way, when you engage with someone from a different environment, specifically speaking about school, there is a power dynamic that, you know, kind of emerges. I don't want to say naturally, but it kind of ends up emerging that, you know, the person who's coming from the private school has an inherent sense of superiority in them. And I think that is the fundamental problem, is that when I am engaging with kids from, you know, township schools, for instance, it's so hard not to come in with the sense of, you know, I am reaching out, I am, you know, stepping down to their level. And I think you actively, as an individual, and I guess as institutions, need to promote actively fighting and saying, you know what, we are both teenagers, we both go to schools, and we both have experiences that are equally as valuable. Yes, completely different, but when I'm speaking to a kid from a school who's a completely different background than me, it's not a thing of I am a savior, I'm helping them. It's a thing of I am engaging with a peer, my contemporary. So I think, yeah, it goes back to, again, just breaking down the, I guess, the bubble that people live in, and the almost pedestal that, I guess, almost is almost reinforced throughout your school career. Because, you know, in getting you to appreciate your privilege, you're always told that you guys are so lucky to be here, you've been given this great opportunity. And yes, maybe that has good intentions, but I think an unfortunate side effect of that is that people then get to a point where they see themselves as the elite, the people who are, you know, I guess, a sense of superiority or importance. Yeah.
So to close, I want to speak about 2024, the election that's coming up, your feeling, your thoughts about that. But I think firstly, I want to ask, are you voting? Are you not voting? And if so, why?
Definitely will be voting. I think that there's very little ways I can justify to myself why I wouldn't vote, because, you know, always people say that you know, vote doesn't count, whatever. Yeah. But I think that if you really do believe it doesn't count, it's not gonna hurt to queue for an hour or two to vote. And I think that for me, I find it uncomfortable to have a political voice in this country, to be the guy on Twitter that's complaining about the ANC or the DA or whatever it is, if the one opportunity every couple of years where I have a civic duty to exercise that voice apart from Twitter, I don't use it. So I just wouldn't be able to sit with myself as someone who engages in politics in this country if I didn't do that one thing. Yeah.
My second question to that is, what's your advice to people looking for a party to vote for, and what should they be looking for?
I think to people our age, I think be independent of your parents. I think that's a fundamental thing. I think you listen to some people and you can almost picture those conversations being exactly parroted from what they heard at the dinner table.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite sad to see almost that people who are supposed to be the future of this country are just so tapped out of politics completely. And I think that's another thing, is that yes, politics has a bad image in this country. Yes, you're seen as corrupt if you're a politician. You're seen as whatever, whatever. But ultimately, it's very difficult to find another successful country where people who have access to education, who are probably going to go to university, who, you know, are going to end up in maybe some of the more influential positions in the corporate world, are completely just checked out of politics. And I think that's a key failing that our country and I guess our private schools are producing, is that people just want to work hard enough or be successful enough so that politics doesn't really affect them. And I think that is a problem. So advice wise, just read, listen to the news, listen to podcasts like this one, you know. Just be checked in. Don't, you know, give up on your country. Don't, you know, don't check out.
My last question to you then is, what's your message to the youth going into 2024, and what should they be looking for?
I think youth needs to stop seeing themselves as like next up. I think we are now. And I think, you know, it's quite a cliche thing at this point. People say, you're not the leaders of the future, the leaders of now. And I think that's definitely true. But I think the youth need to be the people that are going to be making the most noise. And I think they need to be the constituency that parties are most actively promoting to. Because you see now, and unfortunately a symptom of our country, is that, you know, parties, specifically our ruling party, places such a big emphasis on going to, you know, elderly people in rural areas who are such a major part of their voter base. And I think that shows that the youth don't or aren't an important enough political voice. And I think part of that is our fault. So I think that a party going into next year's elections needs to be able to say that if we don't get the youth on the side, there's no way we'll win. And I think right now, I don't think that's necessarily the case. You know, I'm not 100% familiar with the demographics, but I think we do have a pretty large population of youth that are voting age next year. And I think we are essentially, or we need to be in the position where no one wins unless we as the youth are on their side.
Fair. Mm. I think in closing, what's Gwande's message for 2024 and for the future?
For the future, don't lose hope in this country. I think, you know, experiencing countries across the world, and I think we always have a grass is greener on the other side mentality, and I think I'm also guilty of this, you know. But I think it's important to recognize that we actually have something good going here in South Africa. And yes, everything, there's a lot of bad, and I don't want to minimize people's experiences. You know, there's gender-based violence, which is very prevalent, and even things like load shedding should be unacceptable. But I think that it pains me that people are just very disinvested in this country. And I think the message is, don't give up, fight for this country. And, you know, that's just all I hope people can do.
I hear you. I want to say thank you for coming on. Thank you for being a participant in this great conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I think to everyone else, I think he says it well. The only way and the only chance you get to activate your political voice is through your vote. Even if you aren't voting, I think consider why and know your justification. Know your why, because I think if you know your why, it's significantly better than simply being part of a herd, part of a sheep, part of a mob. I hope everyone, to some extent, has gained some faith, some hope from this. And as always, this has been Misunderstood.